As we wrap up 2023, we on the Asset Horizon podcast want to wish you good health, and we want to thank all of our friends and comrades for their support during the past year. It has been difficult for us to bear witness to the unfolding horrors in Gaza, the West Bank, and elsewhere over the past few months, and we do not take it for granted that many of us maintain the privilege of thinking and organizing together during these tumultuous times. Moreover, we want to thank everyone who has supported the release of our first book, Antioculus, A Philosophy of Escape. We thought that our episode with Catherine Everett would cap off the year, but I had been meaning to meet with today's guest since the summertime. Despite our delays, The Stranger returns to the show today to discuss the politics of mental health, Nietzsche and psychoanalysis, and we also indulge a little bit of playful dream work at the end. This episode features a detailed discussion of self-harm and suicide. The mentions are not graphic, but some of what is covered may be uncomfortable for some. Also, we discuss clinical care of trans youth and its surrounding social dynamics. Some of what is said may be empowering for some listeners, but it could also risk recalling trauma as well. So be advised and listen if and when the time is right. Now, before we start, if you appreciate what Asset Horizon has been doing for the past 3 years, navigate to our Patreon page and support us. It's there that you'll be able to receive an announcement about our 2024 reading groups in the next few days. In the new year, we will continue our Deleuze, Deleuze and Guattari, and our Bataille reading groups. Also, in the spring, or maybe in the early summer, we will begin our Klossowski reading group on Nietzsche in the Vicious Circle. We are an easygoing and inviting crowd, so feel free to hop in and we'll go at your pace when you have questions. Okay, without further ado, allow me to present to you once again an episode of Inner Experience with The Stranger. All right, welcome to Asset Horizon, the theory podcast. We've already done the final official episode of the year with Catherine Everett. That's probably out by the time that you're listening to this. And actually, right now, it's just me and my guest, whom you probably can't see. I think we're going faceless on this release. And this is someone, if you were on Twitter like 2 to 3 years ago, they were quite active. And it is The Stranger, AKA DC Barker, who some of you know. He was on Machine Unconscious Happy Hour and he was on our show. We talked about, what did we talk about? We talked about psychoanalysis, schizoanalysis, shared some dreams.
Yeah.
And today we just wanted to just have a handful of topics and almost in freestyle fashion, just kind of throw them out there one by one and just see what kind of conversation we can generate without any like really strong backbone, and you know, we'll try to develop it rhizomatically, as they say in this world. So how are you doing, stranger? How has life been?
Hey, everyone, and you there. Life's been good. A lot has been happening with me. I moved out of America. I won't say where, but I live no longer in America, which I think has been a nice move. And I live by the ocean, and you know, I'm trying to kind of cultivate my own little space, my own little milieu, my own little territory. Literally, I bought a house, you know, making it sound cooler than it is. But I've been kind of out of the Twitter sphere. I took a break. You know, my mom passed. I was really focusing on working and kind of getting some credentials and blah, 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 all that boring life stuff. And, you know, I've had the kind of urge to get back into the theory kind of sphere and the Twitter sphere and just kind of see what are people up to these days? And, you know, how can I join in the conversation, I guess. So that's where I'm at.
Now, one of the things that I remember upon first seeing your account, I think we had some divergent political views, but, you know, some sort of rare or unusual, perhaps, I don't know, maybe life or emotional synergies. I mean, certainly we're both interested in Deleuze and Guattari and the old Nick Land and that sort of thing. Also, I understood that you were a counselor, a therapist, a psychoanalyst. I forget, you're not a trained psychoanalyst. You're a counselor, correct?
I am both a trained psychoanalyst and a licensed counselor. Yeah, so I have a license for the state that I used to live in America. I do virtual work. I worked at a hospital for about 6 years where I supervise, I do some casework, but I also, you know, got a master's degree in psychoanalysis and then did about 4 or 5 years of doctoral work where I trained to do analysis. I was in analysis for 2 of that master's and 5 of that doctor's. So 7 years of analysis between 2 analysts and, you know, I published papers in journals. They're not very good. I won't tell you which ones they have. So I haven't done like lay on the couch and tell me your dream stuff in years. I switched to just hospital work, but I think my psychoanalytic training informs everything I do. And what I like about it is I think, you know, there's a lot of criticism of psychoanalysis, which is incredibly accurate and justified. And there's a lot of mumbo jumbo criticism that is just kind of polemics. And I think my being in the field, you know, I like to kind of leverage that and say like, well, I actually can separate the wheat from the chaff. I can tell you what's bullshit, and I'm allowed to swear here, right?
Of course. Yeah.
Like what's bull and what's actually, you know, a rigorous critique. So yeah, I do both. I do counseling. I do psychotherapy. I can do psychoanalysis. I just haven't done it in a while. So that's what I'm up to.
Yeah. We talked about dreams. I remember we talked about your dream about giving this whole line of folks handshakes. Do you remember that one? Yeah. And I was hoping that maybe we could share some dream stuff today, but actually I want to dig into the psychoanalysis stuff again. Remind me, you studied like a predominantly Freudian tendency. Is that right?
Yeah. I think they would, I don't want to give too much away so people figure out what school I went to, but I think they wouldn't call themselves Freudians, but they essentially are a kind of a new school of Freudian analysts. They're not Lacanians. They're not Kleinians. So object relations, they're pretty much using defense mechanisms as a concept. They're thinking about drive theory that's heavy in the theory and in the practice. They're thinking about transference and trying to be the blank slate that the patient projects on. So they're really digging in and using all of Freud's basic concepts. Yeah, so they're pretty Freudian. I myself am not a Freudian. You can check out my Twitter banner. It's got a files guy there. But yeah, what makes you ask? What are you thinking about?
Oh, I'm just actually trying to recall the conversation. I had intended to go back and listen to our episode. I mean, it's been what, almost like 2 years, 2.5, 3 years almost? Yes. Time just really flies. But I just wanted to get all that sort of gathered back up to sort of find out what it is that you're tethered to as we dig into these topics. We wanted to talk about the connection between politics and mental health. And on the podcast, I would say that we are inclined towards, I mean, depending on which of us on Acid Rising you talk to on any given day, some more so than others are committed to the political piece, broadly construed, a critique of psychology, psychoanalysis, and so forth. Granted, on the podcast, I'm probably the person most committed to taking the insights of psychoanalysis seriously. And I have been in analysis myself twice. But in any case, I guess what I would ask is, in your practical work, are there palpable ways that politics comes up? And how do you sort of navigate the tension between addressing the claims that they make head on and then trying to parse them psychologically or put them into a psychological frame?
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, I think politics has come up, has taken on a new meaning for me in the last 2 years, where I used to be more politically neutral. I think in the last 2 years, I've been seeing a lot more of the trans population come into the hospital I work at. And so this is where I got actually interested in. And like, okay, politics started to feel real in the room with me. These are people who, well, let me start over. So the psychoanalysis kind of school that I was trained in, they kind of train you that folks, you know, working through like gender dysphoria or who are trans or self-identifying any of those ways, that like you can just analyze them just like anyone else. And I used to like toe that line. Okay, that makes sense. Right. This is supposed to be a science. I had a few analysands who are trans, and I didn't think I was helping them at all with like my training or what we were up to. And then I started to see a lot of trans folk in the hospital. And I thought, we're kind of told that like, oh, they need regular therapy. I don't think they do. I wrote a piece on this in my blog. I think we just need to help them get the surgeries that make them feel better.
If that's what they want.
If that's what they want, right? Like if that's, you know, their thing. So I guess I should specify that was the population I was seeing a lot. People that want to get transitions to feel less dysphoric. And it kind of was a tension in my training where I'm like, you know, what I was trained to do doesn't really fit here. I'm not going to sit around and talk about acceptance and like psychological internal conflict with these people because they're just in pain every day, essentially, from something that they didn't choose to have that's unfair, you know. And I'm not even going to go into like people that are like, are you born that way? Do you decide to be that way? I ultimately don't care. If that's how you feel, you know, we can't tell someone they don't feel that way. That's kind of their reality. I just got really interested in like, huh, all of a sudden, all of these kind of political movements about, you know, getting these population the treatment they need and thinking about are regular psychotherapeutic treatments effective from that lens of, you know, helping people accept things rather than going to action. So I might be losing the thread here a little bit, but this started to get me excited because it really hooks up to what schizoanalysis is supposed to be and why it criticizes psychoanalysis. That's the classic schizo out on a walk is healthier than a neurotic on the couch. Guattari's whole thing was therapy should help people get out into the world and do stuff. Therapy shouldn't be this thing that immobilizes people and gets them trapped, their libidinal energies or their time, whatever we want to say, trapped in the room with this other person that's supposed to be the master of their narrative. Therapy is supposed to help people figure out what they want to do in the world and actually go do it. So it was just like a moment of like, I knew all that intellectually, but then it started to click when I was seeing these people who their parents are like, want to call them by their dead name or use the other pronoun, or they can't get. So this is where it gets into like, doctors won't give surgeries or help unless people are medically stable and not suicidal, or at least they have what's called passive suicidality. They don't have a plan and they're not going to act on it. You know, then the political project that links up with therapy becomes, you're currently suicidal. You want to end your life. If we let you out of the hospital, you'll probably hurt yourself. You know, you're starving yourself and because you hate your body. Like, okay, can we do what's effective for you to get the surgery you need to feel better so you can live in the world? At that moment right there is like the combination of psychotherapy and politics. Something is getting in the way of you doing what's most fruitful for your agency and freedom in this world. And you can't seem to get out of your own way there. I don't mean to be judgmental, but that kind of is what's happening. Can I help you do that? Can we work on that together? So that's when I got really interested in like politics and mental health should work together that way. How that transfers into like systems, I have no clue. But just individually, that's kind of where I'm at.
Just to sort of recap what you've described there, you, in acknowledging that folks are getting in the way of themselves, you as the analyst are also realizing the structural limitations of the therapy itself, the practice, your position as a therapist, and so on.
Yeah, I think so. I think when I was younger, I mean, I'm still kind of young, but I'm in my 30s now, and I was in my late teens, early 20s, I thought like, you know, I know what's going on with people and it's my job to help them do stuff. And then the older you get, you realize like, you know, I don't really have the right to tell other people how to live. I only have the right to help them live the life they want to live and, you know, work alongside them to figure that out, which I think a lot of psychoanalysts say that they're trying to go for that. And a lot of therapists say that they're trying to go for that. But I don't know that the practice as it is as a system incentivizes or always leads to that in practice, if that makes sense. So I think analysts tend to say one thing and kind of do another. And there's a big incentive to do that because you're behind a closed door with a singular patient. I don't think gaslighting is happening on purpose, but I think it happens by accident. I think that's part of the process. That is what transference is in a way. But the question is then, and I wrote about this in my blog piece, like, you know, psychoanalysis says transference is kind of the cure or the therapeutic factor. Is it for all people? I don't know that it is. And I'm not just speaking about trans people. There's plenty of trans people that do want to have transference. And when I wrote that blog piece, a lot of people commented and said, this is stupid. I'm a trans person and I'm in analysis and I love it. I said, good. I'm not saying trans people shouldn't do analysis. I'm just saying analysis just sometimes fails to capture all subjectivities because it actually originates from, I guess, like a normative subjectivity. You know, it comes from someone's theory in mind that wasn't a trans person. So I shouldn't get too stuck on the trans issue. I'm just using that as a kind of relevant example for me in my life, but there's a lot of ways where therapy should be helping people act effectively in the world. One other way I was really curious about years ago was like suicide. Maybe this is too provocative and you can like...
We can cut it out if it doesn't work, but certainly keep going.
Most people who commit suicide tend to be on the left side of the spectrum of politically. Right-wing people often don't commit suicide. They often commit murder, you know, like right-wing extremists. People on the left-wing spectrum tend to get diagnosed with mental illnesses more than people on the right. It's like, why is that? Okay, it could be a personality aspect. There could be a socioeconomic aspect. I think there's also a political aspect to it, but I think that's really hard to explore because the second you start to explore that, the right is going to exploit that and say, look, the left is just a suicide cult. And the left is going to deny that because it's very hard for the left to admit its vulnerabilities if the right is going to use it against it in a polemical argument.
Just because that's such a contentious claim, is there a particular study that documents that? Where could folks look to read up on that?
Let me try to find all the research. Years ago, I started to write like an extended blog piece or a book on it. And I gathered all this research that, you know, was from mental health hospitals, health journals, but also news outlets. It's probably all outdated now. And I actually didn't end up publishing that blog or trying to make it into something because I thought this is too contentious, actually. And I thought this will actually be hurtful more than it'll be helpful. But I think it filters into my personal therapeutic practice where it's like a lot of kids and adults have, maybe not a lot, but, you know, selection bias. A lot of the people I see have contemplated suicide, tried to attempt suicide, maybe one or more times, fear that they will kill themselves if things get too bad. And some of their, I think, political beliefs keep them in a mindset that is so negative that they can't get out of that space. And I'm not a pull yourself up by your bootstraps guy at all. You know, to get out of a dark place like that, it takes a lot. It takes care from other people. It takes a community. It takes a little bit of mental health work. But I do think there is this overlap of like the right has got like these strong master narratives and can always externalize violence and blame another. The left isn't going to do that. They'll blame Nazis, which makes sense. You know, they'll get criticized for that. But at the end of the day, they're left with a lot of stuff that's hard and they end up taking it all on and taking on the burden. And then you get a lot of mental health burnout. So I always wonder to my kid patients, especially like, are your politics helping you right now, you know, survive? Because you have to survive and live life before you can have any major political impact. So let's just figure out how to live through the next few weeks before we worry about, you know, all these ethical things, which are valid, but maybe not the priority right now. I'm ranting a little, so I'll throw it back your way and kind of shut up for a minute.
No, thank you for that. One of the challenges as somebody who is on the left and, you know, thinks about these issues, the immediate place that I would go to if I were putting forward not only my political beliefs in front of a stranger, like a psychoanalyst or somebody that I don't know very well, who also has a kind of professional authority over me, one of the ways that I imagine I might react to that is that maybe my commitment to certain political beliefs might become wobbly in the face of your authority. You know, suggesting, for example, that perhaps the reason that I'm unstable is because I maintain these certain beliefs. And perhaps, you know, in the case of somebody who has left-wing politics, what if it's that the beliefs that they have about their boss, for example, their boss is exploiting them, or they're in a family situation, and clearly the way that our society is structured, you know, very Oedipally, it forces us to depend upon our parents. And in some cases, maybe those people aren't the best caregivers for us, mm-hmm. or they might not even be the best of friends or allies to us. How do you navigate the reality of that in specific cases and more generally? Like in the case, for example, where somebody's suffering from poverty, somebody who's living in poverty and going through the kinds of things that, you know, would lead them down a path of self-harm or something like that. I completely understand the sentiment that they need at least a minimum of, if we want to use the word self-esteem, resolve, in order to even begin to approach those problems. But what happens when you do get to a place, for example, where maybe the crisis has been temporarily averted and they want to talk more about their politics. I can't imagine that you didn't have a case like that if, for example, you've been with somebody for a couple months.
That's a fair point. There's definitely been kids where I've told, and this is actually, they've been writing research or not, they've been writing little articles about this in like Psychology Today. Definitely been kids and adults where I'm like, you know, you've got a lot of thoughts and feelings about this and you should find a way to kind of get that out there. You know, I have one kid in particular who I saw in a major city and there were some political tumultuous times and they wanted to go to a protest. And, you know, this is DBT, dialectical behavioral therapy. It's like, I want you to go to the protest and I see how valid it is. And at the same time, I want you to think about your own safety. Will you going to that protest provoke someone that will hurt you? In particular, this person may or may not be not white, you know? So I kind of have tough talks with them about like, what's it like to have a white therapist? Spoiler alert, I'm white. And does that affect my ability to understand you? And, you know, what do you think about the fact that when you tell me you're going to these protests, I have kind of a fear image in my head of you being harassed because maybe you're not white. You know, does that factor into your decision-making, your behavior? I don't want you to be afraid. I don't want to put fear into you, but is there a way? And that's like the tricky thing about, I think, trying to do good therapy, not to toot my own horn. I've definitely done bad therapy, but how do we live in this gray area of like having our political beliefs, balancing it with our mental health, and then figuring out an effective path to actually implement that doesn't get us killed, beaten up, thrown in jail, unless you want to do that. I don't need to help people do that. They can do that on their own. You know what I mean? But how do you actually be effective? So I don't always have the answer, but with this kid, it's like, maybe you can be provocative, but without provoking the people that are really going to beat you. I don't want you to get beaten, you know? I think that's what Deleuze and Guattari are trying to get at in a lot of their project of, you know, their idea of accelerationism is riding these flows, not fighting them, but not believing and endorsing them, but just kind of going with the flow so that you don't go crazy or become a fascist or kill yourself. You know, they talk about that in A Thousand Plateaus. If you go too hard, you'll end up a fascist. You know, you believe in the structures too much. If you go too much with deterritorialization, you'll either go psychotic or kill yourself. So you got to find that middle ground of just kind of riding the flow, as hippy dippy as that sounds.
In a best case scenario, it seems like a counselor or a therapist who is in political solidarity with you and personal and emotional solidarity is kind of like solidarity on tap, or at least can be, because it seems like people who come from a place where they don't have a lot of support don't have people to think things through, like OPSEC or how to just maintain over a week or a month, you know, when you're dealing with lack of funds or something like that. And I think that's the real crisis there, is that, you know, we have a career field that is a stopgap for all of the crises that capitalism continues to exacerbate. And so maybe that leads me to a bigger question then. And I'm not sure if we asked this the last time, but from your vantage point, what do you think are some things, you know, one or two things that you think need to be dialed in differently or changed right now about the way your profession works? And on a more grand scale, what is something that you think that we can effectively change right now in our culture, in our society, to get on track to mitigate some of these problems that you deal with on a regular basis from a psychological perspective?
That's a great question. A few things pop to mind. Some are more polemical or anecdotal. Some are more from my actual like research practice and schooling. The polemical one that comes to mind, and I don't know if I fully endorse this, but you know, I'm just going to talk freely, is like, we actually have to stop with the mental health discourse. Like having like these commercials where celebrities are talking about how they use therapy apps. It sells this idea that that everyone needs therapy. That I think is really dangerous. Maybe not dangerous. That's too, you know, alarmist, but not everyone needs therapy. And this was a self-learning moment where, again, the schooling I grew up in, it's like, well, if you're having a hard time, you probably need therapy. Some kids just need to go out and play and have fun, because they haven't had fun because, like you're pointing out, they live in a shit neighborhood and they don't have a place where they can go play soccer, and that's not their fault, you know? So some kids just need to have good experiences in life. Just like, I guess this gets back to broadening me, you know, using trans people as an example too much. And trans people don't, they may need therapy to help them, you know, with some mental pain and to help them get on with their lives and live the life they want. But ultimately, they just need what they're going to ask for. You know, if they're going to ask for, like, I need the surgery to feel better, let's figure out how to do that. If they're going to ask to learn how to change their body language to feel less dysphoric, let's figure out who you can connect with. It might not be me, but other people out there who do body language, whatever you want to do. Getting rid of the mental health discourse that everyone needs therapy and thinking about therapy as a short-term intervention to help people get back to their life, not something you stay in forever. So that's very counter to psychoanalysis, where you stay in therapy for 20 years or more. And it's even counter to a lot of short-term manualized therapies that insurance will pay for. You can do those forever. You know, I've been at this hospital for 6 years. I've seen more than a few people come back over my 6 years, and they're not being helped. And I love the hospital I work. And if someone figures out how to dox me and shows it to my boss, I will be like, no, I love you guys. But I don't know that they're being helped. They're not being hurt, but we're kind of treading water. We're not figuring out the issue. So less of that. You know, you need to be in therapy. You probably don't. That creates neurosis in itself. You have the tools in you to help yourself. You just need someone to help you maybe unlock those tools. I don't know. That's one of the more polemical ones. What else do we need to change? Well, I guess that's two of them. Let's not commercialize therapy too much, and let's not think of it as a fix-all, and let's not make therapy this indefinite moving the goalposts, because that's epistemologically and ethically kind of bankrupt. You know, every time you make progress, it's like, well, you maybe come back for one more session and see what happens. I've had psychoanalysts tell me that. Well, tell the patient to come back for at least another week to see what happens. Why? That's another X amount of money they just put in my pocket, and I don't think I helped them, you know?
Do you advocate for shorter term therapy? Like, are there instances in which, like, yeah, three sessions is probably all we need?
There have been people I've done that with. There's when I kind of market myself, I'm using market in mock quotes for listeners. You know, I say, like, we can do long-term therapy and I can help you through stuff if you want help. Or I can be really solution-based and I can tell you what I think, but you have to tell me if you think that's wrong and we have to collaborate and work it out. So if you just want a few sessions and you want me to be like, I've worked with people who describe what you're describing before and X or Y has maybe worked, why don't you try that and come back? You know, maybe they try that and come back. They say, yeah, this might be it. And I say, okay, go see if it works. And you can always call me if you need more help. Over time, I've gravitated away from long-term therapy towards, like, again, like I'm saying, let's just do short bursts to get people unstuck and then just have them live life. I think that's Nietzschean too, which is why I call myself a Nietzschean. It's like he calls himself a despiser of all systems. The only point of a system is to get you a little bit of power so you can be yourself in the world. At least that's my bastardization understanding of Nietzsche. But I think it's Nietzsche in that sense. Just get unstuck, transform a little, and see what you do and come back if you have a hard time, you know?
So a microsystem as a catalyst for change and for you to become curious about things and perhaps seek out enlivening pathways, rather than perhaps even thinking interminably in this sort of pathological metaphor, like I'm just going to be stuck on this problem. What are some successes that you have had most recently, or perhaps most notably since the last time that we talked to you, or what do you count as a regular success in terms of dealing with your clients?
When I work at the hospital, and I'm going to be very vague because it's HIPAA. Yeah. So I'll be kind of cryptic and vague so I don't, you know, reveal personal health information. The success for me is when someone comes to the mental health hospital and their tools of living in the world or their way of managing stress or anxiety or bad thoughts or even positive thoughts, if that's getting in their way, which to me does have a certain functionalism, like they can't go to their job, they can't drive their car, or more importantly, they can't enjoy their own mind or their own body or their family or their friends. Can we collaborate with them to help them see that there are better ways that are less destructive and might allow for more enjoyment and freedom? can we show them how to do that for a period of time while they're in the mental hospital? So it's very treatment-based. A lot of mental hospitals are just holding centers where they're basically, you know, I'm not a Foucauldian. I know Will is. Will, only if Will were here.
Good thing he's not, right?
Yeah.
Well, we can speak freely today. We can have that true psychologist jouissance.
Yes, yes. We can enjoy our little system of neurotic.
The plethora of symptoms.
Exactly. But, you know, a treatment center should not be just for holding people. It should be helping them see you can act another way in the world and still, you know, enjoy yourself, but without all the side effects or less side effects. So what is a success? When someone comes in shambles and leaves less in shambles. And for me, that's very real. It means their thoughts, their brain, their mind isn't occupied by noisy thoughts. So a lot of people come in and, you know, if you're kind of psychotic or schizophrenic, you know, you have maybe intrusive thoughts. I'm pretty sure I almost had a psychotic break once. I won't explain why. I'm very, you know, grounded now. But I remember the thoughts would not stop coming through my head and I could not make them slow down. And I had a kind of a panic attack. And I imagine a lot of the people I see, their head, they can't formulate their own ideas or enjoy the world because their head is just full of noise. And we help them quiet that noise so they can actually have some peace and do something in the world. You will have people tell you, I used to love doing art and I haven't done art in 6 months, but I painted my first painting today because I was able to sit and pick up the brush and do it. And, you know, it's moments like that. You know, I won't belabor the point, but it's like moments like that where someone did something that was fulfilling to them and actually contributes positively to the world because someone can walk by and go, oh, what a beautiful painting. Who did that? So that's the therapeutic moment for me is that kind of moment.
It's not a trivial thing to do something like a first painting or a first drawing. There's a real risk there emotionally and existentially, because we can think delusionally about this, about cliches and what have you. But that aside, just the horror of the blank canvas or the blank page in front of you can be so terrifying and evoke so many insecurities, even to somebody who's done it time and time again. You know, I can say this as a musician using something like Ableton Live even, or just getting in the room with bandmates, you've completed an album, you've done the tour, and it's time to start writing new songs again. That can be a terrifying feeling. And imagine doing it for the first time.
Yes, yes. I like that you mentioned Ableton. That's a good aside, because my laptop that I did all my music recording on died 2 years ago, and I just finally got around to getting a new one with music software, and boy, am I behind the curve. I cannot figure out how to like program in Ableton, and like, it's just not the program for me. But I think it's similar to what you're saying, where to start something up again after traumatically stopping it is really difficult, but it's enjoyable when you get back into the swing of things. And ultimately, not to romanticize too much, but that is what life is about. Again, I'm a Nietzschean. It's about having, you know, experiences that create kind of aesthetic objects or things in the world that you can enjoy and other people can enjoy, and you can all huddle around and say, look at that. Isn't that cool?
This kind of collective marveling over somebody who did something so excellent. No, that's great. I want to talk about dreams, but there was one other question that I had. Actually, you know, it just got me thinking. We're on Twitter, and it's always around this time of the year that you see a certain kind of tone or tension ramp up. And I always get like plopped into the For You section, you know, which shows you all the things you don't want to see. But still, when you do see those things, you see more fighting, more angst, more insecurity. Here's one thing that I'm wondering is, what in your experience, you know, over the several years that you've been doing counseling and therapy, what is a common tendency that you see of people who pull out of emotional or psychological tailspins? What is either a defining moment, or what is a gesture or kind of move that they make?
That's a good question. I'm going to share the first thing that came to mind, and then I'm going to try to think of a more elaborate answer. The first thing that came to mind is taking feedback. And I don't mean in a corporate, like, it's such a corporate term now, right? You got to take feedback from your supervisor and, you know, your quota wasn't met. But feedback for me is letting the outside in. And so that's why those terms insideness and outsideness are actually really important to therapy, I think. So many people who struggle with what we would call mental illness, again, that's mock quotes because I don't love this language. It's so reified by now, but we become insular. So we no longer rely on our senses to gather information. We rely on scripts that have been formed usually out of, again, trauma in mock quotes because that word is misused a lot. Trauma, you know, history, bias, cognitive bias, emotional experiences, all of which are kind of burned into us. Some people say burned into your brain. There is a brain aspect, but I try to stay away from brain science because it's, again, pretty reified. So what do I mean by this? Like, again, I know diagnostics, but I try to think not diagnostically. Like someone with OCD, let's just speak plainly, they've learned in this world that they need rigid patterns to survive and manage anxiety. And if you take the patterns away, the anxiety is overwhelming and they feel like they're gonna die or explode or something terrible, right? So people with OCD, if it's really bad, they often come to conclusions very quickly and then believe the conclusion, and then that's insular, right? So I've had someone say, well, if I do that, then X will happen. And I've said, or let's use narcissism in a non-judgmental way. I had this kid once many years ago. No one in this group likes me. Why should I talk anyways? When I used to do group therapy, I'd say, well, I would kind of be a little irreverent and funny with them. I said, that's really mean of you. They go, what do you mean? I had good rapport with them. They go, I'd say, well, you're telling me what I think. How are you in my head? You know, John, Jane Doe, telling me what I think about you. That's a little selfish of you. Well, what do you mean? I'd like to hear from you. Anyone else in the group, do you enjoy hearing from so-and-so? Some people will say, yeah, I do. And then so-and-so will say, well, they're just saying that to be nice. And a few answers, you can say, well, what's wrong with that? What's wrong with just being nice? You know, so there's like ways to get playful. But what I'm getting at is the kind of narcissism or the insular response is to already assume that your script about the world is right. So you're just following the script. You're not letting in the outside feedback. So again, kids will come and they'll have all these ideas, often kids, and I'll say, do you want to check any of those ideas with your parents or with me or with another peer? Like, what's your best friend think about that? You know, well, I never thought about that. I never thought about asking them. Why don't you go ask them and come back to me tomorrow and see what happens? Or do you want them to come into therapy next week and we can ask them what they think? So letting the actual outside in. And again, what does that sound like? Deleuze and Guattari, where they have that whole section of like why the analyst won't allow the analysand to bring in the tape recorder. And Guattari is like, because it's going to let the outside in, there'll actually be this pseudo objective reference point for what's being said. So the analyst and the analysand can't muddle the waters anymore and make shit up in this insular loop.
That's kind of what a podcast is sometimes, you know, the big others in the room with us now, right? The thousands of listeners out there. No, that's interesting. And what I'm going to take from that is the using the distinction between the outside and the inside to overcome the judgmental patina of narcissism. Once that word is out there, it does things. Yes. And I think pulling that back and looking at things just strictly dynamically, like is the thought process that you're having just strictly insular? You know, are you able to take feedback? My wife and I were having a conversation today about somebody that she knew, a client. There was a question about blame shifting and responsibility. And, you know, she asked me like, you know, what sort of advice would you give to me on how to deal with that kind of person? And it just made me think there was a time in my life where I felt very depressed and disconnected and maybe making, you know, like with certain friendships, having a failure to launch and like grow with people in certain ways. And then it just kind of came down to a question at one point where I was confronted with the idea that, well, maybe there's something that I'm not doing. Like, what's my part in all of this? And really just stopping, you know, just asking the question of oneself, taking a moment to reflect on it, and maybe not even coming up with an answer, just the rupture of the question
yes.
is enough to set a different course.
Yes, that is it. That is exactly what I'm describing. And I think we're both Nietzscheans because you said it's not about personal responsibility. That is what blocks so many people from having that moment where they go, wait a minute, what's my part in this? because there's so much moralistic guilt in our culture that, you know, we defend against that so often. You know, we don't want to take responsibility because if we do, a million different parties are going to jump on that and dogpile on us and blame us for other stuff too. So we're defending ourselves against unfairness, but in doing so, we can't take the fair feedback. So when I do family therapy, that's almost always what needs to happen. Is parents are like, well, you know, blah, 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 we're doing all this stuff because, you know, and I say, mom, dad, or dad and dad, mom, mom, whatever the family is, your child may ask you 10 things, seven of them might be things you legitimately cannot do for them. But there are three of them that you can, and you're throwing the baby out with the bathwater when you miss those three. And every time you miss those three, you deplete your relationship with them again. And they're, of course, you're going to keep acting out because you're not sorting out what you can really respond to. And you're just going to make them insular. They're going to say, I don't want to participate in this family because it doesn't protect me. It doesn't give me anything. And that's why your kid doesn't want to do stuff. And you're being cold and authoritarian because you think that's somehow going to get them there. No, it's not. So that moment, this is beautiful because it gets us back to that dream that I share with you, because that's what that dream is about. When I said all my bullies were lined up from my middle school and I went down and shook their hands and said, yeah, I get why you did that. So I don't endorse bullying at all, obviously, but I had a moment in my dream where I realized, geez, I was probably a little shithead. And that doesn't make it right that they bullied me, but I definitely did things to catch their eye and provoke their ire. And they targeted me because of that. And if I wanted to be effective in the world, I needed someone to say, hey, it's not fair, but you might want to act differently. And that's actually a very provocative DBT skill we use for dialectical behavioral therapy. Marshall Linehan, is there's this intervention. It's very provocative. And it's sometimes you might need to act differently to get people to like you. So often getting people to like you is not a good goal, but sometimes in life, these people want connections and they want love, but they can't get it. And it's like, you might need to act differently, but that's unfair. It is unfair. And we might still need to do it. I will help you tolerate that if you need that. I will hold that for you. So again, I'm getting too animated. I'm getting too excited, but you hit the nail on the head with that moment of like the rupture and the insular feedback.
Well, now I want to dig into this Nietzschean question, because we're basically replaying, I guess, on a different track, something that we discussed in our last conversation years ago, was this tension between forgiveness and forgetting, right? Like, this is the big Nietzschean question. And just to flesh that out for anybody who doesn't, you know, really know what we're talking about here, Nietzsche's whole thing is that the whole tradition of forgiveness, as it comes down to us through the Judeo-Christian tradition, has nestled within it the germ of revenge. And he puts forward the idea, like, what would be better is to enhance this faculty that we have within us of active forgetting, a kind of filtering out of the accretion of memories and pain and suffering and so forth, so that we can maintain. Now, this doesn't mean necessarily or at all that we should forget everything. You know, there's certain things that we need to react to as existential threats, you know, to maintain relationships. Sometimes it's good to have attention to build a relationship. Every relationship has a metabolism that involves both pleasurable experiences and painful experiences. And so now with that on the table, I just want to ask you what you think the role of forgiveness is with the Nietzschean lens on, because clearly if there's a family issue going on, just to pull from the example that you just discussed, I don't know if you want to either elaborate more details or spell a new narrative. There is a moment in which if you have a gripe with someone or you feel resentment towards someone else, it seems almost common sense that you would at least need to acknowledge that that person was suffering. I mean, maybe it isn't common sense at the end of the day, but what I have found is that if you're not able to get acknowledgement from the other person that you identified the very reasons that they feel slighted, if this sort of minimal process of justice or restorative justice doesn't take place, this other thing can't happen where we transcend it. Now, this makes me think, well, maybe Nietzsche's kind of missing something here, or maybe this is still a kind of reactive attitude. And what Nietzsche wants us to do is espouse ways in which we go beyond even that. What do you think the role of forgiveness is against forgetting?
That's great. Well, I think forgiveness has to be spontaneous. And I want to use the word accidental, but that's not really doing it justice. It has to come about from a process. All therapy is really process oriented in that sense. So what do I mean by that? Well, parents will say, well, I did this thing and my kid doesn't like me for it. Like parents who hit their kids, you know, and there's interesting research in some cultures, parents hit their kids and everyone does that. So kids actually don't have traumatic responses. That doesn't mean I endorse that, but it's interesting because everyone is in that water. There is nothing to compare it to. So everyone's like, we all just grew up getting hit. We didn't think anything of it. And you test them. They don't have any trauma symptoms. In any culture where there's more freedom and diversity, which are good things, you're going to get trauma symptoms because you can go to your neighbor and say, well, you don't get hit by your dad. And then you realize, wait a minute, there's a way my parents could help me that doesn't involve me experiencing physical pain. So the person who's supposed to love me hurt me. And that's where trauma comes in. So trauma isn't a subjective thing that is transferred. It's a cultural comparison thing. So why did I go here? Well, you'll see parents who are like, yeah, I was worried my kid was going to run in traffic. So I tackled him and threw him in the back of the car and brought him to the ambulance. So then the kid is like, I'm not speaking to my parents ever again because they hurt me. And tricky, you know, because I say to the parent, well, like, I get why you're doing that. You're trying to prevent your child from getting killed. And can you also see how your child doesn't really understand that or see that? And even if they did, it still caused them pain and discomfort. And those are their feelings. You're not going to magically make those feelings go away. You have to acknowledge that. And you have to hold that. You have to say, what I did was hurtful. And I wish I did something different. And I did that thing. You have to hold those ideas together. And that's when kids go, all I needed you to say, Dad, was that that hurt me. And that's when kids will actually start to go and be vulnerable and go, and I know you were trying to save me, but it still hurt me. And then I go, look, guys, you know, and then people will say sorry. And I go, you know what? Let's not do apologies in here, actually. Let's talk about what to do differently next time. So that actually is restorative justice for me, is instead of just like hollow apologies, it's like, let's actually figure out a different plan. So the next time we don't have to do this again, and we can compare and think, oh, good, we made progress. But you said something important there. People have to acknowledge that they hurt other people. And this goes back to narcissism. So many people don't want to imagine that they've ever hurt someone. And they can't see that someone else might see them differently than they see themselves. And to actually have a therapeutic moment, you have to almost have this moment where you're like, I don't need to agree with you or believe you. All I need to know is take you at your word that I hurt you when you're saying that and I hear you. So that becomes like a therapeutic cliche, you know, that I hear you. But when done meaningfully, that is where the repair happens. So I can elaborate more on that, but that might have been a little jumbled up. I don't know if that kind of stirred anything in you.
In fact, I can kind of connect it back to theory to put a Nietzsche bookend on this part of the conversation, which is, I think about the concept of Nietzsche's perspectivism, and there's definitely some debate about what that means. I tend to go with the Deleuzian reading, maybe even the Klossowskian reading too, which is actually not that far in many senses. What we mean when we say perspectivism or Nietzsche's perspectivism is that there are a multiplicity of drives. And at any given time, we can be captured by one of these. The connection that I made just now is that in a relationship with someone, especially over time, as you develop resentments and so forth, there's a polarizing effect. And there's probably even a calcifying effect to the extent that it's makes it harder to take the position of the other person's viewpoint or any other person's viewpoint for that matter. And it's isolating. It puts you in an emotional silo. And to be able to take on the affect of a real or imagined other, I think is a feat of what we call active power and having that sort of mental, emotional, spiritual freedom to be able to see what it is that you're doing from the perspective of another person, another drive, so that you can make the evaluation, make an adequate evaluation about what it is that you're doing or how you're hurting, or maybe even how you're being hurt, because that's the other side of it. Some people who can't even acknowledge that they're being hurt by somebody else.
Yes. Yes. And it makes me think of the Nietzsche line from Zarathustra that's always stuck with me, where he says, one must become a large body of water to take on a polluted stream. And this is an aesthetic theme that follows through that whole text and in his notes, that you got to get big to take on all the stuff in the world and not react or be poisoned by it. So that's classic Nietzsche, the kind of ingesting metaphors, you know, because all the stomach issues and all that. But you have to contain other people's stuff without letting it fill you up with resentment. While you were speaking, though, I thought of another forgetting. So, like, where does forgetting come into therapy? Is often, and this speaks to your idea of like calcification. I'll see kids with a huge rap sheet of just like they got arrested, you know, they trashed a schoolroom, they tried to stab their parents. They're nice kids. They've made some decisions that make people see them in a certain way. And, you know, maybe they've tried to commit suicide and it comes time to discharge them. And the discussion is, well, are they safe enough to go home? Okay, that's tricky and anxiety-inducing question. The parents and a lot of the other kind of social worker types are always like, well, they have to have all these supports in place. Well, what does that do? That just further pathologizes someone. That sends them the message, you can't be a normal kid and that you're only capable of being bad. So that induces learned helplessness, right? That old behavioral concept where no matter what, I'm damned. You're damned if you, damned if you don't. So I might as well be a punk.
That was my choice. Yeah. Like that, that's exactly what happened to me with in the principal's office as a kid.
Right. Your history defines you. So I talk a lot about with my supervisor at work or the folks I supervise of like, let's not let the history define this kid. Let's see how they're acting in the moment. Are they saying they're going to kill themselves or their parents when they go home? No, they're saying they want to figure out how to make it work. Okay. So history needs to be weighed. But we do need to tolerate our own anxiety and not act as if their history is who they are now. And that's what we have to do, I think, with everyone. We have to give them the benefit of the doubt. People say, well, what if they go home and kill themselves? I guess I'm going to jail because I fucked up and was supposed to not do that, you know, but we need to follow the evidence, not our anxiety, you know, so forgetting has that function of allowing freedom. You know, that's the only way people are going to change in therapy is if you assume they can make different decisions, not assume they're just going to make the one they always made. So
interesting. Yeah. I know we've been recording for about an hour. Are you good to go for a little bit more?
I'm having a great time. This is a fun conversation. I hope you're having a good time.
Absolutely. Yeah. I want to talk about dreams.
Yeah, let's do it.
Maybe that's how we can leave off. You know, I could go for hours on this stuff, but the problem is then I got to edit it. So
yeah.
But anyway, maybe we'll start with you first this time, because maybe we'll try to do a little improvisational dream work for ourselves and then and have a meta discussion about what it is that we're actually doing. You mentioned that you had an interesting dream lately. I'd like to hear it and what sort of insights you derived from analyzing.
I've had two dreams about my father. I shouldn't start with that. I'm already framing the dream. I'm a bad analyst and a bad analysis. Person gets on the couch and they say, I had a dream about my dad. The first thing you go is okay, what was it really about? But okay, all jokes aside, I had a dream. I'll just start with the content. I'll just tell the story as I remember it. I'm in this elaborate house. This house is like multi-dimensional and like shifting, almost like in Harry Potter, not involving anything there, but you know, like the staircases that move. And I'm thinking, what a wonderful home. The more I explore the home, the more I realize there are unfinished parts of it. All my dogs are there. So I have two dogs, and then I have two dogs I'm fostering. They're all there. And I'm way up in this home, and there's this unfinished hallway. And I think, I have to get my dogs over this unfinished hallway. There's this huge gap. They're going to fall. And my dogs all fall. But I look, and I see that they land safely. Oh, thank God. I make it over the gap. Somehow I end up on the ground level. There's all these like edifices and statues. And I think this must be built for a pharaoh or something. Some king made this. I go into the basement. So our Jungian brains are already going. Who's there but my father? And it's like a basement type garage. So he's like in the garage, you know, he's like got papers in his hand and he's like directing and he's doing yard work. And I say, Dad, kind of tug on his sleeve. I'm like, can I have a hug? And he says, I don't have time for that. And I think, oh geez, I better go find my mom. And I wake up. So that's one dream. The other one is shorter. I'll just tell it really quickly because I think they're part of the same conflict I'm trying to work through. The other dream, I'm getting my hair cut by my dad. And I decide to tell him, you know, why don't we squash our beef and just figure out how to be friends again? And he doesn't respond. And I go, huh, I guess I shouldn't waste my time doing that anyways. And then I wake up. So two dreams. The first one is obviously much more interesting in a macro sense. The second one has hair cutting, which is interesting. But those are my two most recent dreams that I thought, oh, geez, I'm trying to work through something. There's one other before it, but I'll tell that after. It's probably related, but I'll tell it after.
Well, I want to ask about the first dream. So we have the figure of the father, an image of your real life father in the basement. He's taking this authoritative position. He's giving commands. You know, when I think of the word basement, you know, my Jungian brain or my Hillmanian brain switches on, where this is the chthonic domain of the soul versus the spiritual high heights of the mountain. And it's interesting that you went to that place to demand intimacy from someone who is in the midst of a kind of managerial task. I don't have time for this. Yeah. You know, I'm preoccupied with this. I don't know. I think there are some very, I hate to use the word common sense again, but, you know, our intuition is triggered when we say things like father, basement, mother, hug. It seems like all the pieces are there, but maybe there's something else that you got from it.
I think the house is because I moved into this new house that my fiance and I bought, and we've been here for almost a year, and I'm doing a lot of like maintenance on the grounds and making sure it's like my first home. I'm making sure the place is intact. You know, oh no, is there like a little, are those termites? Oh, I got to call, you know, all that stuff. So some of that is what's called day residue from Freud, where it's just my actual operating mind and brain trying to solve solutions. My house is incomplete and it could hurt my family, my dogs, right? It's built for a pharaoh. You know, that's when I probably start to think about, associate in my head about like, who is this home built for? You know, what does this contain? I think me taking care of the home, I think often about my dad never taught me how to do this stuff. So I'm teaching myself, you know, I'm watching YouTube videos on how to do carpentry stuff. I'm watching YouTube videos on like how to identify different insects, planting plants, like stuff that, you know, I think you do this kind of stuff too, outdoorsy stuff, but I wish I had a dad who showed me how to do that stuff. So I'm teaching myself. I'm becoming the father, the kind of boomer dad that I did not have myself. But that's the connection between the home, the pharaoh, and then my brain or my mind makes the full depiction of my dad in the basement. I think some of this is probably, this gets meta, but some of this is probably too picture perfect of a dream because I've been so entrenched in psychoanalysis my whole life. My mind is just kind of trained to use the motifs to produce dream work narratives. You know, they joke people who are in therapy with Kleinians have Kleinian dreams. Lacanian patients have Lacanian dreams. That's mm-hmm. how the mind works.
Right.
And then the hug thing, you know, I like your soul, like the cavern of the soul association, because I think I'm trying to figure out bad habits of mine that are probably, you know, scars on my soul or something dark on my soul, dark spots, shadow parts of me. So I'm in there and I'm trying to think, are these bad habits of mine because I wasn't loved enough? Will love fix these bad habits of mine? How do I become the man that I never had in my past in the future? So there's something happening there with there being an absent model and me needing to be that. And when I speak of bad habits, you know, it's like my own narcissism, my own coldness, my own, do I drink too much sometimes? And, oh, I wake up and I think I shouldn't have drunk that much. Why did I do that? You know, my own avoidance of things I need to do in life, you know, all those things.
What stands out to me, for what it's worth, is the tension between the way that I imagine it is a father you know, making furious, almost frenetic gestures with his hands while trying to organize affairs in the basement. To me, that's almost ironic or comical, is to engage in this sort of managerial activity in the seat of the soul. Yeah. And what you're doing is you have this very specific ask that happens down there. There's a way that my reading of your interpretation of the dream looks edible from the outside looking in. But what I think is interesting is you're not answered with a hug. You're not answered with anything. The cliffhanger of the dream is, in your demand for intimacy from this figure who will not give it to you, you are in a very intimate place to begin with, the basement. The fact that you said you had recently moved is also interesting too. Actually, I'm going to pause. Have you read Gaston Bachelard's The Poetics of Space?
I have not, but I saw it on the Twitter feed recently.
Yeah. You, of all people, absolutely need to read at least the introduction and the first chapter of that book, because Bachelard has a whole phenomenology of the house, the home, the hearth, the intimate spaces of a home. And one of his theories is that our image of the childhood home gets recapitulated in other dreams in various ways, and the image kind of fractures and fragments and gets flung out over the imaginal domain, to the extent that we might have a dream and just see our childhood bedroom in the middle of a cave or something like that. And he actually pushes back on a lot of reductive psychoanalytic and psychological readings of dreams. And I think he does so in a way that would really be jarring in the best of all possible ways for somebody who's interested in psychoanalysis. So that's your homework for this over the next year or so.
I'm going to do it. That sounds really interesting, actually. Does Fisher talk about that in The Weird and the Eerie? Is he citing him?
Oh, you know what? I think he does.
So it's familiar, because I wrote a blog post on like my own approach to hauntology. There it is. That's my favorite Fisher book, by the way. That one is just like a masterful text on epistemology, actually. I think Fisher is a wonderful epistemologist of all things, but
I don't see it's not in the bibliography.
Okay.
Maybe he mentions Bachelard in passing, but it would probably be in the bibliography if he did.
I'm going to read it, because I had this whole like kind of cockeyed, harebrained stuff about, you know, thinking about ghosts. Ghosts only ever appear in the basement or the attic. And that's such a Western tradition. But in the East, ghosts appear in the forest or the mountains or the rivers. And it's like, what's like the Western world's interest with haunted basements and haunted attics? You know, it's in poems, it's in movies, it's like the trope. Well, maybe this is where I made the Fisher connection, like The Shining. I think Fisher talks about The Keeper. What's the audio? What's the band?
Caretaker. Yeah.
Yeah. Talks about The Caretaker, which is inspired by The Shining, and The Shining has the whole kind of the house is the entity itself and blah, blah, blah. But this, put in the chat that book, and I will just Google it now and either find a free PDF or just buy it. So that sounds really interesting.
Bachelard was a huge influence on James Hillman, who's a Jungian. Some call him a post-Jungian. I like the idea that James Hillman is actually a pre-Jungian, that he is getting back to the Neoplatonic roots of alchemy and soul making that Jung tries to make scientific in his work. Mm-hmm. But I think The Poetics of Space is nice because, as I said, it creates this confrontation between, for lack of a better term, a kind of raw phenomenology against the science of psychology. And mm-hmm. And a theory of the imagination that I would call even nomadic. It maps on, there's a way in which it has resonances with Deleuze's Bergsonianism, even though Bergson is a target for Bachelard. Hmm. But what Bachelard likes to do in his discussion of the imagination is often talk about the production of the new, how new images are produced. And so this is what you'll absolutely love too. The very last chapter is on insideness and outsideness.
Okay.
So this is probably something that you're going to connect with quite a bit.
I touched on that in this ghost piece I wrote about, because I just was thinking, I was probably like sleep deprived, but ghosts are kind of only scary when you're inside and trapped with them. Like, imagine every ghost story, but you take away the haunted house and it's just like a big haunted space. You feel less scared. Y'all just run away in the other direction and the ghost isn't going to get me. Ghosts are scary when you're like cornered in an attic And the only way out is the way it came up, and it's blocking the way. So inside and outsideness, haunted houses, attics, basements. Yeah, this is all resonating with stuff I've been thinking about and getting me excited to check it out. I can't believe I've never checked out this this guy before. What era is he from? That's not the right way to ask that, but you know what I mean.
He wrote that book in 1958. He's responding to the psychoanalytic tradition. He's also responding to the tradition of phenomenology. And he's a precursor to the post-structuralists. I mean, he's somebody who Foucault works with. You see inflections of his work. Deleuze and Guattari mention him in The Becoming Animal Plateau. And it's somebody that they kind of push against, but also at the same time utilize. And I would even say it's very French in the sense that it talks about the incommunicability of inner experience. There's a question of that. So there we're thinking about Blanchot, Bataille. I'm not sure to what extent you've worked with those texts, but yeah, you'll love it. I promise you, you'll love the introduction and you'll definitely love the first chapter on the home. But before we wrap up, I'll tell you my dream.
Please do.
And maybe we'll have a little chat about it. I feel like I need to establish some context for my dream against Bachelard, or maybe in distinction to Bachelard. I tend not to dream about my childhood home. I don't think I've ever had a dream, a notable dream that has taken place in my childhood home. Although a common theme in many of my dreams are shopping malls and Turkish bazaars. I've never been to Turkey. The interesting thing about the dream that I had recently, it connects with another dream that I had that I did an active imagination session with. I often see in my dreams women to whom I'm attracted to, but drawn to by like a very sort of subtle power. And using the the Jungian paradigm or the Hilmanian paradigm, this could be like an anima figure. So, you know, as someone who is read up on that, that's the way that I express my predisposition towards Jungianism or Hilmanianism. But anyway, I had a dream maybe about 2 or 3 months ago where I started walking on a plane, like a wheat field. That's what it was. It was a wheat field. And it was the sun, maybe just before sunset. Like it's not the sun going over the horizon, but almost like the golden hour where the rays of the sun are nearly horizontal, you know, and you're feeling that warmth. And for once in my dream, the woman who I was attracted to was my wife of all people. And, you know, like these things are very telling. Like I tell my wife these things. And so But I found it interesting because it was in that dream she became my partner in that world for the first time. And in the sunset, I saw the most magnificent, gigantic lioness that you would ever see, just standing there, and just a radiant beauty, just me observing it and absolutely loving it. And then I recently had a dream, a series of dreams, where I'm all over this Turkish bazaar, sort of M.C. Escher world that I'm ordinarily in. It's one of those dreams where I spy a woman from across the way. And throughout the course of the dream, you know, her features are shape-shifting somewhat. And then once again, for the second time, this woman turns into my wife, as I know her. And suddenly we realize like that we're in the bazaar together and it's time to leave. Things are hectic here. We need to have a space apart from this, a space alone from this. And so we start trying to navigate our way out. And once we do, I'm in that very same field of wheat again. I mean, the wheat, the stem or the stalks of these wheat is so thick and the grains are so robust. There's a kind of searing, but comfortably searing heat to the sunset light. And as I navigate the field, I find what appears to be like a little, like a hole or a trap door in the ground. And I open it up and it's just filled with casks or barrels of wine. And the casks, they fall down and they form a set of stairs. And I start going down the stairs. And as I continue going down the stairs, more and more these casks of wine, they just start producing like this fractal array of other casks of wine. And I'm going down this sort of M.C. Escher painting of stairs that are casks of wine. And we just start having a blast doing it and having a great time. And as I'm going down the steps more and more, that just keeps happening. And the dream ends. And it was just the most phenomenal dream. Like, I woke up, I was just kind of laughing, like how like just funny and enjoyable that was.
I love that dream. I'm having like a lot of reactions to it. Like, my first joke thought internally was like, damn, I want to trade my unconscious for yours. There's probably resentment in there. Like, I want you to have this nasty unconscious I have. But I'm like, I never have dreams that bright. But my thought is, you know, I forget. Either Jung or Winnicott has a term for dreams like that. I don't remember what the concept is, but the word that keeps coming to mind is like, it's like a reconciliation dream where I wonder, you know, if you've turned a corner in your life or something and you're leaving something behind and it's a little bit of a sacrifice. And now you're really saying, you know what, I'm giving up on some things to really put my eggs in this basket and be with this person I love and form a new world. And it's going to be fucking bountiful. You know, there's going to be sun and wonderful power, Linus's power, and wine and bounty overflowing. So for me, the fact that these women become your wife, that is very Lacanian in a way. Your fantasy becomes the mundane object. And I don't mean your wife is mundane, but I mean, it's like an inversion, right? In our dreams, we can dream about like anything we want, whatever we find to be unattainable, and no one can hold it against us because we're not doing anything bad in reality. But you dream about something you already have, which is one of the most touching things ever in a way. Mm. So there's something really cool about that, I think. Something reconciling the past and a sacrifice with a bountiful future. I don't know what you think about that, but that's where my mind went.
I almost hesitate to celebrate the dream so much because the one thing that I guess there were tensions in the dream.
Okay.
There certainly were uncertainties. Like when I turned to the woman and the woman was my wife, I was like, it's you or it's been you. It's been you all along. Like there was a question there as to whether it was her all along or the woman had become her. That was interesting. And then, of course, the escape or the flight from the chaos in the dream, there was, you know, a moment of reflection or remorse. Like, is this something that I want to leave? Is this something that I want to abandon? Because, you know, in as much as maybe those forces were so chaotic or so very difficult to understand, or being in a multiplicity sometimes can be alienating too,
true,
right?
True.
And so within the context of that dream, you know, even though there was this sort of like chaotic, sometimes fun, often strange, sometimes nerve-wracking multiplicity, there were moments where it felt utterly alienating. And then like when the sun came over the horizon, it almost dispelled it, like almost as if a spell was cast and that world was gone. And there was an anxiety about being on the plane, about being on flat land. And this is the interesting thing. Okay, now it has occurred to me that all of these Turkish bizarre dreams that I have are in elevated spaces. It's like Cloud City stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, the buildings are tall, there's annexes or bridges that go between the rooftops, and a lot of the dreams are spent up there. And this is one of the very first dreams that I had where I went down to ground level and I started going down a set of stairs that was in the earth. And so the wine was in the actual earth. It wasn't in a building.
I'm out of practice, clearly, because the first thing you're supposed to do is not as an analyst go, like be like, hey, I assume that this is positive because I think it is. But there are tensions in there that I didn't pick up on. I wonder, you know, I think it's still a beautiful dream. I wonder, what's your association to it? Are there day residues that are like filtering in through your sensory system that make you frame certain narratives? Are there like conflicts that you see in the dream? And maybe you don't want to share some of that stuff, but I always
think it's fine. Yeah. I don't know. In the wintertime, I think that's when I drink a lot of wine. You know, like that's, I don't drink as much alcohol in the summer, I guess. Oh, also I love my cat and she plays with wine corks. So like whenever I pop a bottle of wine, I throw the wine cork to her and she'll carry it around. I think wine is you know, the association there is a home, hearth, family, love, definitely femininity too.
Yeah.
Definitely a feminine element to it. Receptivity, I would say. But I think the surprising feeling was fun.
Mm-hmm.
The surprising, like, I mean, how many times do you have a dream that was fun? I've had those dreams in the past where like I'm flying around my backyard.
Yeah, yeah.
That was fun, you know, but rarely do you have a dream that's an escape that's fun.
You're making me think, I'm going to share one dream in association and you can cut me off if you're running out of time. But like, I think the cat is the lioness, you know?
Oh, I didn't even think about that.
Maybe that's too literal, but.
No, that's good. You know? Yeah.
But when you're talking about fun dreams, I've definitely had those fun dreams where I'm flying around, but I had the nicest dream in college where it had a lot of sun in it. I was climbing the tallest mountain and everything was photorealistic and the sun was so bright. And I thought, what a beautiful day. This is wonderful. And I remember waking up super depressed, but I remember thinking like, geez, this is my mind trying to keep me going. I can do anything, you know, it's trying to give me hope. So I think there is something about fun dreams have to do with sun. Maybe there's some science there. Maybe there's some research there. I don't know. Jung would have a lot to say about the sun, the soul, the dream where he had where the sun's phallus came down and all that stuff. Anyways, I won't get sidetracked with all the Jung stuff. But
I wonder too if there's a like seeing the shaft of wheat too. That's Orpheus, right? Where he goes into the underworld to bring back the. I don't know. Like that's total myth nerd stuff. But
I don't know much about. I don't know much about that stuff anymore. Maybe at one point I did, but over my head, but I believe you.
I think what this is going to prompt me to do is actually take a second look at that. I mean, I don't often dig into my myth books these days, but that's something that I'm going to do. Well, do you hear my cat? That's my cat screaming. He's announcing the end of our podcast here today. It was great to see you again, stranger. We'll probably have you back sometime in the future, but anything you want to say to fans and listeners to cap off 2023?
I mean, I just want to say thanks for having me. You're just, you know, a pleasure to talk to. The other Acid Rising guys are cool too. And, you know, say hi. I don't know. I just want everyone to be well and have a good new year. And, you know, just do your best out there, I guess. I know that's cheesy and stupid, but, you know, that's how I feel.